Case number 18-5380, John Collins versus James David Green. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Williams, you may proceed for the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors. Please support Edward Williams for Petitioner John Collins. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Fine.
This case is not about whether Mr. Collins is guilty or not guilty of the crimes for which he was convicted. This case is about whether he was granted the constitutional rights guaranteed to him in the process of reaching that conclusion. The answer to that question here is simple. He was not. This is so because Mr. Collins was tried in a single case for disparate charges that should not have been joined in the same trial. As a result, Mr. Collins was convicted of two murders, but if the misjoinder had not occurred, there is a reasonable probability that he would not have been convicted on one charge because of the weakness of the evidence, and a reasonable probability that he would have been convicted of a lesser included offense on the other charge. If the court will indulge, I would like to begin with the standard of review and why de novo review applies here as opposed to the higher or more deferential AEDPA standard. Collins is entitled to de novo review for the simple reason that the Kentucky Supreme Court decided the misjoinder question not on the basis of deprivation, but instead on the basis of the Kentucky Rules of Criminal Procedure. This case is like English, where this court decided that de novo review was proper in a habeas setting. Like English, where the Michigan Court of Appeals decided the case on a different basis, the Kentucky Supreme Court decided this case on a different basis than the constitutional deprivation. Like English, there was a dissent that animated the flaw giving rise to the constitutional issue. The dissent in the Kentucky Supreme Court specifically stated, and I quote, "Moreover, appellate was deprived of a fair trial by the inherently prejudicial joinder of two crimes that were not closely related in character, circumstance, or time." To be sure, the Kentucky Supreme Court's dissent is not raising the constitutional issue, but neither did the Michigan Court of Appeals concurrence in dissent. It merely animates the flaw in the majority's decision-making and tells this court that the Kentucky Supreme Court's majority decided this case on something other than the constitutional question. Third, like English, the prejudice inquiry that the Kentucky Supreme Court engaged in was not the constitutional question. We know this because the Kentucky Supreme Court never asked, is there a reasonable probability that the outcome of this trial would have been different?
Did the Kentucky Supreme Court majority decide that there was not prejudice?
No, Your Honor. The Kentucky Supreme Court determined that there was not prejudice with respect to, or as prejudice is understood under the Kentucky Rules of Criminal Procedure. It's actually a similar issue occurred in this court's decision in English. There, the Michigan Court of Appeals did also engage in a prejudice inquiry, but this court in English determined that the Michigan Court of Appeals prejudice inquiry was not the prejudice inquiry that was required by the Constitution. We submit that that is the same here. The particular issue with the Kentucky Supreme Court's prejudice inquiry is what I would consider a missing the forest for the trees issue. The Kentucky Supreme Court dives directly into, as many high courts or state Supreme Courts do, at query of as to whether or not its Kentucky Rules of Criminal Procedure should be interpreted in the same way as its compatriot Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. But it never asks or zooms out of the question, and this is actually the fight that the dissent is having with the majority, and never asks the question whether there's a reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different but for the misjoinder. The fact that the Kentucky Supreme Court cites federal cases, Fenton and Bowker, is also of no support to the conclusion that de novo review does not apply.
Well, can you explain, I'm a little bit concerned about understanding why the prejudice determination of the Kentucky Supreme Court does not, in effect, do the same thing, even if they didn't ask whether there's a reasonable probability that the outcome might be different, do they do, in effect, the same thing?
I think that they did not do, in effect, the same thing, Your Honor. And I think this goes back to what I have contextualized as kind of the missing the forest for the trees. By jumping directly into the comparative analysis that will be conducted under federal rules of criminal procedure, it misses the initial inquiry is actually what the dissent in the Kentucky Supreme Court is fighting about, that the dissent suggests, the majority should have asked whether these were actually connected crimes, or in that, and if the motive theory, specific with the Crystal Wilson shooting, if the motive theory was supported by anything other than the prosecution's subjective theory. The district court, adopting the magistrate judge's report and recommendation, actually finds, as a conclusion, I believe it should be considered a conclusion of fact, that there was no proof, there was no proof connecting the motive theory to the Crystal Wilson charge. And so the situation is that the Kentucky Supreme Court's prejudice inquiry is missing the step that the dissent animates, which is that it should have asked whether or not these were so disconnected, or if the prosecution's subjective theory was based or supported by anything other than the theory itself. And I think that is why de novo review applies. If there are further questions about standard review, I would like to move to the merits, Your Honor. On the merits, the question here, there are two ways in which Mr. Collins' constitutional rights were deprived. First, the joinder of a substantially weaker charge with a substantially stronger charge gives rise to what the Ninth Circuit and Bean v. Calderon called spillover effect, and where in Bean, the Ninth Circuit granted the habeas petition of the petitioner because of the connection of two misjoined charges, one where it was particularly strong and one where it was particularly weak. Like Bean, there were two murders, one supported by significant evidence, one not supported by significant evidence. Unlike Bean, however, where there was a limiting instruction offered by the trial court, no limiting instruction was offered here that instructed the jury that it needed to consider the evidence separately. Furthermore, like Bean, the evidence here was not easily separated in the mind of the jury. The jury sat through 23 state witnesses, Commonwealth witnesses. 21 of those Commonwealth witnesses testified as to the Stevie Collins charge. Only two specifically were placed on the stand to talk about or to testify to the Crystal Wilson charge. If accordingly, Your Honors, the fact that the evidence was about two shootings, which occurred approximately 40 days apart, it would have been difficult, absent a limiting instruction of any kind, for the jurors to differentiate in their mind the evidence that applied to the Stevie Collins charge or the evidence that applied to the Crystal Wilson charge. Accordingly, as in Bean, Your Honor, this court could grant the habeas petition if it so chose, only with respect to the Crystal Wilson trial, which is the weaker charge.
Mr. Williams, can I interrupt you because you don't have much time left? We've talked somewhat at length about the standard of review, and you're now talking about the imbalance of evidence between the two charges. Unless I've missed it, you've failed to mention what I thought was the core of Mr. Collins' concern about the joinder, which was his being forced to choose whether he wanted to testify, he said, at the trial of the Stevie Collins murder, but did not want to testify at the Crystal Wilson trial. Is that still a part of your case?
Yes, Your Honor, and I apologize for not getting to it sooner. I believe that there are two ways in which the court could grant the habeas petition. One is based on the spillover effect in the Crystal Wilson charge. That's the Bean v. Calderon comparison. The other alternative is the one, Your Honor, Judge Gibbons, that you just raised, which is that Mr. Collins has a constitutional right to testify on in his own defense, but he was foreclosed from that ability, from the right to do so, because he would have also had to stand and take questions on the Crystal Wilson charge, which the district court found he had a good reason not to testify in. He had important testimony to give and good reason not to testify. The important testimony that Mr. Collins had to give in the Stevie Collins charge is evident by the gaps in the defense's presentation. Mr. Collins would have been able to testify as to his state of mind when Mr. Stevie Collins approached his father, Harold Collins's property with a bottle of liquor in one hand and what John Collins would have testified is a gun in the other. Mr. Stevie Collins, based on evidence brought out by the Commonwealth, was legally intoxicated when he arrived at Harold Collins's home to confront Harold and John Collins. Mr. John Collins would have also been able to testify as to his mind state, his mental state, and whether he was emotionally disturbed after his father first shot Mr. Stevie Collins. He also would have been able to testify as to whether or not Mr. Collins's invitation to, quote, go to church, as mentioned in the Kentucky Supreme Court's opinion, was actually a veiled threat and not a genuine invitation to religious exercise. Your Honors, this failure by the trial court to allow Mr. Collins to testify as to the Stevie Collins justification defense, which he has asserted from the beginning, he would have asserted and made evident in his testimony, is a constitutional violation. And we believe that whether the court applies de novo review or the AEDPA standard, Your Honor, that he's entitled to a grant of his habeas petition. I see that my time has expired. If there are no questions at this time, I'll reserve for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Havey?
Thank you. Again?
Please proceed, yes.
Okay. I guess I'm going to start with the standard review also, since that was brought up. There's a rebuttable presumption, of course, that the federal claim was adjudicated on the merits. And I'm going to point particularly to Wilson versus Parker, already reviewed the Kentucky Supreme Court's application of the state court standard of review. That was regarding severance of defendants, but the same prejudice and abuse of discretion standard review. And they said that this court said that was not an objectively unreasonable application of Lane. The Kentucky standard review is consistent with this court standard review and with constitutional standard review and joinder severance issues. The petitioner's trying to incorrectly shift the burden to the warden to show that the Kentucky Supreme Court means something different by prejudice and abuse of discretion for state review versus constitutional review. And our courts never had that distinction. And he relies on English versus Burgess, which is unapplicable there. The lower court, the state court, did not reach the merits at all of the petitioner's claim, and on the face applied a less protective standard. This was a juror failure to disclose issue, and prejudice. The petitioner does not have to show prejudice, and the state court made him show prejudice, so that was less protective. So that's not analogous at all. And I agree that in our case here, the state court, the dissent was arguing on state grounds. Our dissenting opinion was essentially anti-Lane. The dissent took the same opinion as some of the circuits did before Lane and said, well, if there's a misjoinder, then it's automatically reversible. And Lane, that was our dissent. And our majority, without citing Lane, applied the Lane standard and said, no, you still have to have... No, our majority also argued, stated that there wasn't misjoinder to begin with. So
does your position hinge on the state Supreme Court majority's finding of no prejudice being identical to a federal standard under Lane?
Yes, or less. I mean, it's it, It's identical or more protective. It's not less protective than Lane. That's correct. Now, our Supreme Court was looking at prejudice in terms of misjoint. Our Supreme Court said it wasn't misjoint, so they didn't have to go to harmless. But it's the same, similar standard review. It was not less protective at all than Lane, which is it's prejudice.
Well, did they? Your opponent says the Kentucky Supreme Court never asked whether there was a reasonable probability that the outcome might be different, which would be part of the federal constitutional standard, right?
Yeah, I think our federal constitutional standard, if you get to harmless, it's whether it's the Cotico / Brecht standard, if you get to harmless error, whether it's substantial and injurious effect or influence in determining the jury's verdict, which is the state standard was no less protective than that. Again, this is our state has applied the same standard for federal and state review as far as I'll go back to the Wilson, whether it was whether the court was clearly convinced that prejudice occurred and the likelihood of prejudice was so clear that the failure to sever was an abuse of discretion. That was in Wilson. That was consistent with Lane. So our Supreme Court is no imposes no greater burden on a defendant in that area. So again, in English, the state court had a whole different standard. They required prejudice when prejudice wasn't required at all. So that is my position that the state court is entitled to deference because it was within the federal standard review, even without particularly citing Lane. If you read the majority's footnote one particularly, it's a Lane argument without actually citing Lane.
Was the Lane case cited actually in the state court?
No, it was not. The defendant presented his arguments as state ground and state law grounds. And then on his particular selective testimony argument, he did present a solid, an actual constitutional argument. And then he wrapped it up with some references to federal due process. So Lane wasn't cited at the Supreme Court or in the majority opinion. But again, of course, according to, the Richter Williams standard and Early versus Packer, they don't have to cite Lane as long as they've applied the same standards that U.S. Supreme Court would have. If I can go to the merits, now he's petitioners alleged two distinct forms of prejudice and one related to each of the offenses, and on both he's taken multiple positions at different stages of the proceedings. He's claiming that joinder prevented him from selectively testifying in mitigation. Now, at the trial court, he vaguely argued a need to testify regarding justification. And now there's an elaborate story that's presented for the first time in this court here about the Stevie Collins wielding a gun. There's none of that. There's no basis for any of that. No evidence, and the petitioner didn't argue that. He just said he would like to present a justification defense. So the Kentucky Supreme Court applied federal constitutional-based decisions, including this court in Bowker, and he failed in noting that the defendant petitioner failed to make a persuasive and detailed showing of he had an important testimony to give in one and a need to refrain in the other. But I want to jump ahead to the habeas the district court, where actually the petitioner told us what he would have testified to in his reply pleading. We should listen to what he had to say. He did claim at this point, no longer justification, but mitigation, that he had to kill Stevie Collins because Stevie was dangerous. And if they let him go, then he would have come back and for revenge. And so he had to, that was his own statement in the reply pleading that I quoted in the brief, that he had to kill him to eliminate that threat that he'd come back later. That's not justification. In fact, if he'd have testified to what he actually wrote in his pleading, that would have been a confession to murder. It's mitigating to a degree, but that was put into evidence to his other witnesses that Stevie is dangerous, and the petitioner said, you know, I had to finish him off because we can't let him leave here. That's consistent with the evidence is what he wrote in his reply pleading. So there was no story about it. I mean, the only gun story comes from GS, gunshot residue on the victim's hand. That's the only evidence that they've cited that there was a gun, and that he was shot by Harold Wayne Collins face to face. So there was never anything about a gun in the lower court, about Stevie having a gun, no evidence, and just vague references to justification, which didn't put the court on notice that he had to testify selectively. I'm going to jump ahead to the other allegation. This is the one the district court raised sua sponte. that the cumulative effect of multiple charges suggest a criminal disposition. The Kentucky Supreme Court's determination that the second murder was connected to the first is not an unreasonable application of Supreme Court law. I mean, first, the Supreme Court determined circumstances in themselves permitted a reasonable inference of motives, given the facts of the case. These witnesses were the only thing that were ever going to tie defendant and his father to the first murder. They couldn't make a case until witnesses started talking more than a month later. Second, the Kentucky Supreme Court made an actual factual determination looking at the trial evidence itself that I think that was overlooked by the dissent, that petitioner testimony at trial, the petitioner threatened one of the two surviving witnesses also. He told Ms. Saylor, she testified that she was threatened by both the petitioner and his father. So with the petitioner killing one witness, I mean, we have the second witness saying she was threatened also. And then third, I think there's references to the trial court basing its joinder decision on what the prosecutor represented. But in fact, and that's true, the joinder decision itself, but there was a bond hearing immediately after the joinder decision. And there was witness testimony. There was an investigator who testified that Melanie Hicks interviewed, during an interview of Melanie Hicks, the victim, Krista Wilson, confided to her that petitioner threatened to kill her and cut her tongue out if she spoke about what she saw. So that was actually evidence before the trial court after the joinder hearing, but before the severance hearings. That was sworn testimony from the investigator about his interview. And plus, Natasha Saylor testified at this hearing. And she testified at the hearing that the petitioner told her and Krista Wilson both, you'll be all right as long as you keep your mouth shut. So the Kentucky Supreme Court, that was not an unreasonable application for the Kentucky Supreme Court to rule that those cases were sufficiently connected. The motive evidence of the first case would have been admissible in the second murder. I'm going to jump to his other issue that was raised based on the sua sponte finding. Now at the trial court, petitioner argued that evidence he killed Krista undermined his justification defense. He didn't argue the spillover the other way around. So this is the opposite of what he argued at the Kentucky Supreme Court. Now, based on my last argument that the Kentucky Supreme Court was not unreasonable in determining that the evidence of the first could be used to prove the second, this court in Wilson suggested that if the evidence is admissible, whether the prejudice in a joinder, because if the evidence could have been admitted anyway under 404, then you don't have to go any further on that. What Wilson suggests. So it's unnecessary to weigh the strength of the evidence that petitioner killed Krista. But I mean, there was Saylor's trial testimony that he threatened her also. There's trial testimony, they were last seen together. Petitioner said they were going to a Hector to party, and Hector's where her body was found. Petitioner told an implausible story about her getting out of his vehicle and into the vehicle of a man with a green truck. And then when he killed her and dumped her body, he backed his SUV, his old Blazer, bumped it into a rock and left paint behind. He hit the bumper. And there's two experts, one for the state and one for the defense. But when you look at their evidence testimony, there's not really any difference. Just the way they're willing to say it. That was the same paint, clear coat, primer. It's just the expert for the defendant testified, well, there were different thicknesses. Even the samples were different thicknesses, and the substrate material, whatever was below all the primer surface, was different. So those three layers, the clear coat, the paint, the primer, both witnesses, again, the defense witness wouldn't say identical, but he admitted that they were the only difference he could come up with was the difference in the thickness. So that was the defendant's paint.
So one question, your opponent said there was no limiting instruction given at the trial to limit and to direct the jury to find separately vis-a-vis the two different crimes. Could you address that?
I can address that. Well, first of all, he claimed that they're muddled and the jury would have trouble keeping them separate. You go back to his severance motion. He acknowledged that his argument there was those cases are distinct as to time, place, and witnesses. And that's true. I mean, there were two different places, two different victims. You didn't have any spillover, no confusion between the cases. Now, as far as the limiting instruction, number one, the petitioner Kentucky would give an admonition for a limiting issue. Petitioner did not request one, and you can't complain you didn't get one if you didn't request one. He's never raised the issue in the state court, never raised that until this court, until reached the Sixth Circuit. And the limiting instruction addresses a potential for prejudice, but isn't a constitutional requirement. And in this case also, how do the admonition the instruction that he requests requires the jury to consider the evidence of each case entirely separately when it's admissible under 404, you could actually consider the evidence of one case and another. So possibly some admonition could have been given, but certainly not the one he requests when you have the evidence of the first shooting is admissible to help prove the evidence of the second shooting, his motive, why he would have killed Crystal Wilson. So the limiting instruction he requested was inappropriate. And again, it's not a constitutional requirement and it wasn't requested. Is there any other questions? I kind of rushed through some of it because I didn't know if I'd get through all of it.
Any further questions?
No.
No questions then. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Williams, you have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I would like to make one point on the standard review conversation and then move into responding to some of the merits conversation. The Commonwealth relies on Wilson, but Wilson's actually very helpful to petitioner on the point of whether the standard review should be de novo. In Wilson, the Kentucky Supreme Court plainly stated, and I'm going to quote, "The failure to grant the defendant a separate trial from his co-defendant denied him a fair trial and reliable sentencing contrary to the 6th, 8th, and 14th Amendments to the United States Constitution." We have no such from the Kentucky Supreme Court in this case, and accordingly, de novo review should be applied. On the merits, Your Honor, there are, as far as it presenting the defense that Stevie Collins, in the Stevie Collins charge, there was an attempt by the defense to bring evidence into the trial about the gun. The residue, which the Commonwealth just also referenced, was an attempt by the defense to bring that the evidence of a gun into the trial. Furthermore, the defense asked Natasha Saylor while she was on the stand whether she had actually taken a gun from the scene of the crime that was used by Stevie Collins. Again, the reason why these holes in the defense exist is because John Collins was denied his constitutional right to testify at the trial without also testifying on the Crystal Wilson charge. On the imbalance of evidence, the evidence that the Commonwealth cites that potentially connects the crimes were not brought out at the trial. The jury did not get the bond hearing testimony that the Commonwealth raises or the severance hearing testimony. The jury only heard the evidence that was in the trial record and from that perspective, the evidence was disconnected. One last point on cross-admissibility. The Kentucky Supreme Court's a discussion on cross-admissibility was incomplete because even if we assume it is admissible under 404, the Kentucky Supreme Court never conducts a 403 balancing analysis to determine if the evidence is, even if admissible under 404, nevertheless in 403 because it is unduly prejudicial. The Kentucky Supreme Court's own precedent says that such analysis is required to determine whether other acts evidence may come into a particular trial. There's no prejudicial determination here. And that, Your Honor, further undermines the Kentucky Supreme Court's analysis with respect to the state charge, but most certainly undermines the constitutional application. Your Honor, for the reasons that we've stated in our brief and here before you, we ask that the court grant Mr. Collins' petition for habeas. Thank you, Your Honors, if there are no further questions.
Thank you. And Mr. Williams, I see that you're appointed pursuant to the Criminal Justice Act, and we thank you for your representation of your client in the interest of justice.
Thank you for the opportunity, Your Honor.
For your argument, and the case will be submitted.